Now I want to introduce our keynote speaker today, Professor Danielle Citrin, who is the Lois Macht Professor of Law at the University of Maryland Law School. And as you know, many of you, I hope, know Danielle by name and reputation, if not personally, because she's been a major figure in the internet policy arena for many years now, focusing on some of the dark side of the internet, the issues associated with online bullying, hate speech, harassment, and other kinds of conduct online. Obviously, she's the author of the 2014 book, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. And she's here today to talk about revenge porn, hate crimes, and what Silicon Valley and the law should do and is doing about these issues. And one of the interesting things that I heard this morning in the presentations was this remarkable convergence between the privacy issues and the data security issues that for a long time, I think, those had been treated as somewhat related, but also somewhat disparate. And I think what we've seen over the past 2 years is how powerfully the data security issues are driving data custodians, data stewards, to consider their data management practices in ways that also affect data privacy, in terms of retention, in terms of partnership relationships, in terms of a whole host of issues. And I think what is remarkable, and what Danielle, I think, is going to talk to us about, is now this convergence between the issues of online bullying and online harassment, which I had always looked on as sort of criminal and free expression issues and sort of a First Amendment type issue. Danielle, for years, has been saying these are privacy issues. And now I think we see with the hack into the iCloud celebrity files, for example, and the way that those were then, you had a security issue that became a harassment issue, really, to me, vindicates what Danielle has been saying for many years, but brings it very strongly forward as issues that now those who are holding data and who had previously looked upon their privacy obligations, their security obligations, now have to think about what are the consequences and harms that may arise when that information escapes, and the very seriously negative and criminal ways that that information can be used. So without more, because this is just going to be such a fascinating way of tying together issues that any data custodian has to be worried about, please welcome Danielle Citrin.
Thank you so much, Jim, and for everyone welcoming, you know, everyone at BCLT welcoming me here to talk about. So I'll focus on revenge porn, and I think, Jim, you're right. What has so brought the issue of the non-consensual posting of nude photos into our consciousness, I swear I've been banging on about the broader issue for 7 years. And in the last 18 months, it's been sort of amazing that we've captured the sort of, I think, nation's attention. And the security, I would say, breach or hack at the iCloud, and then theft of the celebrity photos, and then, of course, both non-celebrities and celebrities alike, coincided also with the attacks on women in gaming, Gamergate, that really, I think, brought into focus an issue that we've long wrestled with, but now are understanding as truly harmful phenomenon. And I think at the same time, coming this week is particularly exciting, given the sort of changes at Twitter and Reddit, to ban non-consensual pornography, and businesses seeing that they too, or they are a crucial player in the phenomenon of cyber harassment is incredibly gratifying. So that's basically what I'm going to talk about. I'll explain the sort of the broader problem of online harassment, its harms, what law can do and its limits, and then what companies can do and are doing. Okay, so what is cyber harassment? Just as a basic definition, I'm going to borrow from criminal law. It's the repeated targeting of an individual, a course of conduct that causes substantial emotional distress and often the fear of physical harm. But much more important, of course, is to understand how it's perpetrated, right? So there are kind of four central ways in which harassers stalk individuals, and it's often a perfect storm of all of these things, right? So they terrorize people by threatening violence and by impersonating them online and suggesting they're interested in sex, and then often including their home address and contact information. They post reputation-harming lies and often manipulate search engines to ensure that the lies are prominent in someone's name. They invade privacy by hacking into computers, stealing confidential information, SSNs, and often intimate images. And they post them online. And confidants who have gotten intimate images with the notion of trust and privacy betray that trust and post that for the world to see. And lastly, harassers use technology to basically silence people and kick them offline, engage in like distributed denial of service attacks to shut down websites. But I think what's most important, obviously, I have to give you an example to have this issue really come alive for you. And I'm going to talk about a woman who, when she was a PhD student, her new name is Holly Jacobs. But when she was a grad student in her first year after graduating from Boston College, she had a long-distance relationship with someone. And they shared intimate images with each other and videos. And it was a two-way street. And it was on the understanding that the photos would remain, of course, for their eyes only. So after they break up, about 6 months into the grad program, she starts getting emails and texts from strangers saying that they saw her ad and that they're interested in sex and want to meet up. And so this is 2009. What she does is Google her name because she wasn't in the habit of doing it. And what she found was really terrifying. At over 300 revenge porn, and then online like singles dating sites, including like Adult Finder and others, were her nude photos, videos of her masturbating next to all of her contact information. So her work address, she had a part-time job while she was, you know, also teaching graduate, you know, undergrads, but at a consulting firm. So her work bio, her home address, her apartment, right? Her cell phone number, her email, and many of the posts suggested that she was available for sex. Other posts, the tagline was something like hot for teacher with her full name, suggested she was sleeping with her students. You know, she taught undergrads as part of her PhD in industrial psychology. So besides being sort of contacted by strangers, you know, an overwhelming number of strangers by text and email, someone sent her part-time employer an email that looked like it came from her, and it said, and it, all it did was just include the links to the nude photos. And her university, the HR dean, like the dean of students, I suppose, got an anonymous phone call that suggested or claimed that she was sleeping with her students, and then referred the dean to the websites, right? So her dean, of course, calls her into the office and said, "What is this about?" She explains, she had a very understanding dean at the time, but said, "You know, you really got to change your name, Holly, right? Because we can't have you teach undergrads and have them Google you before class starts, right?" And she felt like she had really no choice. There's like 10 pages of a Google search of her name where these posts were. So she spent hours and hours contacting the sites to see if they would take it down, and she filed notice and takedown claims because often she had, many of them were self-shots, right, that she took of herself. Most sites just completely ignored her. Some, much in the way that Jeff was telling us about, right, wrote back and said, "Oh, for $400, right, will take down a photo, right, as a grad student, which she didn't have. And what's interesting, a few sites took it down, but they were often outside the United States. Like some Russian site was incredibly helpful and kind, took it down, who knew, right? But what she found was like a whack-a-mole. Every time she would get things taken down, more would emerge on other sites. So Holly's case, I wish I could say that it's unique, but it's not, right? So the Bureau of Justice Statistics estimates, and this is from a study from 2006, so we imagine that it's certainly grown, but that at least 850,000 people experience cyber stalking every year, or stalking via networked technologies, right? And they define it in the way that I did when I first began, right? So the study was pretty rigorous. Now, the majority of victims are female, but males experience online cyber harassment too, and it follows the same playbook, right? It's sexually humiliating and sexually threatening. So it's not just threats, like any old threats. It's typically rape threats, or for men, threats of anal rape. And it's not just any old lie or reputation harming, you know, defamation, but it's the suggestion you have a sexually transmitted infection, that you're a prostitute, right? Like demeaning lies, right? And it's not just any old privacy invasion, but so often the posting of intimate images or doctored images, right? Putting someone's head on a naked body to suggest that they shared nude images and their contact information. The fallout from online harassment is so steep, right? So for many victims, they fundamentally change how they live their lives. They move, they have to get new jobs, as Holly did. She left her part-time job because the work address was all over the internet, along with, you know, her nude photos. Many change their names, right? The professional costs are also really steep. Right, so I've talked to far too many victims who've lost their jobs, clients, patients, right? And we know that it can be really difficult to get a job when your online reputation is decimated. A 2009 Microsoft study found that this, of course, will be common knowledge for all of us, but over 80% of employers use online search as basically a CV tool, right? And that in over 77% of the cases, there's a negative result. And I don't think employers necessarily believe, right, that individuals are prostitutes or have provoked this sort of response in people for justified means. It's just safer and easier, right, to hire someone who doesn't come with this kind of baggage. So as between two equally compelling candidates, right, you're going to pick the person who doesn't have to worry about this kind of abuse and won't have clients looking at it and saying, why did you hire that person, right? And it's emotionally devastating for victims, right? A woman told me she would wake up in the middle of the night and panic and think, oh my God, what's next, right? So she would Google her name, sort of filled with anxiety that the next shoe was always going to drop. And it's silencing, right? It drives people offline because often when victims stay online or keep their online presence, it's like a provocation to abusers. So they basically withdraw. So law can do something. It's not that law can't do anything, right? So victims can certainly bring civil suits against their harassers to the extent they can find them, right? They can sue for intentional infliction of emotional distress, public disclosure of private fact, defamation, right? But it's so often much more of a kind of theoretical idea. In practice, it's incredibly expensive to sue, right? And even if you have the resources to sue someone or have the wonderful pro bono counsel like the Cyber Civil Rights Legal Initiative, right, it just may make no sense because your defendants are often judgment-proof, right? They have really nothing to chase after. So what about the criminal law, right? There are stalking, harassment, and threat laws on the books, right? But part of the problem is enforcement. So victims go to law enforcement, and because law enforcement has so little training in the law of cyberstalking, harassment, and threats, and because they lack the digital forensic expertise, you know, often victims are told, just turn your computer off, ignore it, it'll go away, right? And I think it's just hard for law enforcement, the more I talk to folks in law enforcement, it's just hard to admit when you don't know something, when you really don't have the set of tools to really investigate, right? And so Holly, if this is not going to surprise you because it's Florida, but when Holly went to law enforcement, they said, buy a gun, you know, protect yourself, like as if that was really an option for a young 24-year-old, right? I know, it's just so, it's hard to swallow, right? And that's just true of so far too many victims, right? And so it's documented, reported, and covered by police foundations that we know that they have a hard time with stalking, and cyber stalking they have that much of a harder time with, right? The idea is it's words and images. Relax. No one's ever going to, you know, confront you offline, which is absolutely not true. When it comes to revenge form, you know, the non-consensual posting of someone's nude images, in over 50% of cases, the victims are confronted by strangers offline, either via network technologies or in person, right? So there is a real risk of strangers, right, contacting you for sex because these posted, you know, these images have been posted online. The sort of next part, so we've got an enforcement problem. We also have, I think, a legal reform agenda that we need to at least put on the table for criminal law, right? So in over 40% of the states, we have harassment and stalking laws that only cover abuse that's directly communicated to victims. So a case from New York, Ian Barber, a man in New York was allegedly sent his ex-girlfriend's nude images to her employer via email, her parents, and he posted them on Twitter. Now, he was charged with aggravated harassment, but the charges were dismissed. Why? Because New York's aggravated harassment statute only applies to communication sent directly to the victim, right? So wouldn't have, you know, obviously wouldn't cause her professional harm to have him send her own picture she took, you know, right? So we've got to update the harassment and stalking laws in a technology-neutral way, right? And Congress has done it with its telephone harassment statute. I know we have the ability to do so. We just got to motivate state lawmakers. The other part of the problem is, you know, so in 34 states, it's not a crime to post someone's nude image without their consent and in violation of their sort of confidence and sexual privacy. And I think fundamentally, we should understand much of this abuse as a civil rights violation. When individuals are targeted and their life opportunities totally upended, often because of just who they are, it's very little that many harassers know about individuals besides their gender or their, you know, their race or sexual orientation, right? There's a harm to kind of groups in society that tort and criminal law just don't capture, right? And, you know, Amanda Hess said it so eloquently. She's a journalist for Slate, and when she was describing her own harassment experience with rape threats, she said, you know, when people threaten to rape me and sexually humiliate me, what they're saying is to all women that they can't be at ease online, right? But we have a way to go to catch up civil rights laws with the sort of contemporary problems. It's not that there are no success stories. So this is where we can call out the Attorney General of California, right? We have law enforcement officers who are taking on the problem of revenge porn. And AG Harris, her office, e-crime unit, convicted Kevin Bollert, a revenge porn operator, I won't repeat, right? But basically for a scheme of extortion, like much as Holly, you know, went to You Got Posted, his site, or Is Anybody Down? And said, can you please take my nude photo off the website? He said, sure, for $400, right? And so we're seeing revenge porn operators face criminal prosecution. And God bless the FTC, so our friends are at, where's Laura? Okay. Brought the very first case against a revenge porn operator, Craig Britton. On the I take it as a theory of it's an unfair consumer practice to induce breaches of confidentiality and then to basically exploit these photos that have been shared without people's permission. And there are 22 states plus Puerto Rico that are considering bills to criminalize the non-consensual posting of pornography. So I think there's some sort of great movement, slow. I feel like, you know, after writing about it for 7 years, you know, finally people are paying attention, but God bless, I can take it wherever it comes, right? But we know that law moves really slowly, right? It's a blunt instrument. And I think what we're seeing now are companies stepping up to the plate and answering the call and saying it's not okay, right? So I guess the question of this keynote is, well, what can businesses do, right? And what are we seeing them do? I think the first is for companies to take a stand, right? Like post-Gamergate, where were the voices saying it's not okay to threaten women in gaming for just making games, right? We did see some, like I think there's a software association that came out, but I wanted to hear more voices, right? Think about the Mothers Against Drunk Driving campaign and what it did to fundamentally change how we view drunk driving, right? Companies can do the same, especially online platforms, to tell their user communities that this is not okay, right? The posting of someone's nude image without their consent and often in violation of their confidence isn't acceptable on our site, right? And we're seeing online platforms do this, right? So helping victims and reinforcing messages, right, through their content policies. So just, I want to say, like, I feel as like it was yesterday, right, that Twitter made the announcement that it was banning the posting of nude photos without someone's consent on its website. Reddit did it last week. I think what we're seeing is a commitment on companies to say, you know what, we didn't do so great in the past. We know and realize this is incredibly harmful, and we're taking a stand, right? And so what companies, of course, need to do is be clear about what they mean by revenge porn or non-consensual pornography, and what they, if you're going to ban harassment and stalking and threats, be clear about what that means, right, in your content policies. And explain the consequences of that behavior, right? What happens? And provide a really easy way for victims to contact sites to report abuse, right? The sort of interesting question I was talking about last night at dinner with folks was, well, how are we going to operationalize the Twitter reporting system? Right, and so in talking to folks at Twitter, victims are going to report the non-consensual posting of their nude photographs. And then much like when you report that someone has an imposter account or is impersonating you, you have to verify that you are who you say you are, right? And I think what Twitter is going to do is require that people submit some form of identification, which is something I think we ought to think hard about for harassment victims who, like Holly Jacobs, when she believes it was her ex, impersonated her on Facebook and was friending all of her friends. And before he put up the nude photos on the fake account, she contacted Facebook, said, this is not my account. This is frightening. And the person wrote back and said, well, send your photocopy of your driver's license. And Holly's response was, the person I think who's doing it is an incredibly technically sophisticated person. I'm afraid I'm going to get hacked. And so the person didn't help her figure out another way to identify herself, right? I think more creatively about how we can do that. So wherever Michael Esposito is in the audience, he was helping me think through last night ways of authentication that we might talk to these companies about that are putting at less risk PII, right? But what I love about Twitter's response is that rather than putting the onus on victim to show up with or to send a copy of an arrest report, which is something companies have been thinking about, right? If we ban non-consensual pornography, we're going to insist upon having a police report, which frankly would never be written out, right? Because law enforcement tells them to just go away. But instead, they are kind of taking people at their word, right? Once they identify themselves, right? And that does, of course, in the thumb on the scales, right, it does open up the sort of mischief story of the anti-porn advocate, you know, folks who are against porn, right? And that's just something we have to weigh and balance. I'd rather see us put the thumb on the scales in favor of over-compliance than in helping victims because of how damaging it is. But it's surely in practice that Twitter's going to figure this out and get it right, right? We'll have to just sort of see them as it goes. And I think companies should think about this stuff at the design phase, at the rollout of your startups, at the rollout of your platform stage, and making clear, as the New York Times editorial board did today, so Chris Wolf showed it to me, it was too brief, but said, look, yik yak, before you rolled out your your anonymous app, you should have thought about banning harassment, stalking, and threats before and setting the norms for your user community rather than reacting later. And that's exactly right. Look, they don't have to, right? Of course. They don't have to say anything, but if they're going to care, they should do it explicitly and at the sort of startup stage, right? And to the extent that we can design security and privacy into platforms and systems that would, and also nudge us to be our better selves, right, on these platforms, I think that's also something to think about. And we can support anti-harassment groups, or businesses can. So Holly Jacobs has this most phenomenal story. When we met, when she contacted me in 2009, at first she wouldn't tell me her phone number because she would only call me. She was afraid that, you know, she'd get hacked and exposed. And I would encourage her. We got to know each other, and I said, you really should talk to reporters. I'm having some really interesting journalists talk to me, and they're starting to write about this. And you're so articulate and compelling. And she would use pseudonyms. And she was terrified. And she finally, at some point, sort of broke down and said, you know what, I want my life back. I'm not going to explain what my former last name was, right? But, and she kind of went public and now runs the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative, which has been sort of instrumental in getting state lawmakers to change criminal law. So I think, you know, I always think kudos, you know, that it's an extraordinary story. I wish that most victims, like those, the folks that I feature in my book, I wish I could say it's true for all of them. This is so rare, right, that she was able to do this. So many people just escape. You know, they hide, basically, and withdraw. So I think this is precisely the time that we should think about this, right? That is, this is our sort of moment. You know, as we share more and more personal information, whether it's through Fitbit or biometrics, right, we provide opportunities for exploitation, right? Personal sensitive information that's going to be used against us, right? And so I think the time to act against online harassment and abuse is now. So I'm excited for your questions. Yeah, Joan. This is what happens when you're friends with people in the audience. It's like a class. You can call on them. Yeah.
I read the book and think it's terrific. And I just wonder if in a kind of shorthand version, you could speak to the First Amendment.
Sure. Right. And I didn't hear because I thought my task was, you know, what can companies do? But thank you for prodding me to do that. You know, it's so often the response is, it's ones and zeros. It's speech. There's nothing we can do. Right, in this space. So whenever I give talks about this, and I have to explain, look, the First Amendment doesn't act in absolutes. There are categories of speech that receive either very no or negligible protection. So we can think of defamation of private individuals about purely private matters, right? True threats, which of course we're contesting with US versus Alone is what the standard is, but we don't protect true threats, right? And crime-facilitating speech, like solicitation, it's unprotected speech. Extortion. And there are other categories of speech that receive less rigorous protection. So let's think about the public, regulations that protect the privacy of our communications about purely private matters, right? So we know cases like Bartnicki versus Vopper, right, would help us, I think, work through how we might be able to criminalize revenge porn. I think another way to think about it, and I've advised lawmakers, to only punish the person who knowingly betrays someone's confidence. So breaches of confidence fall outside the First Amendment. It doesn't have First Amendment salience, right? Because you can agree to contract around the First Amendment, and you can do it in an implied and an explicit way as well. An intentional infliction of emotional distress when it comes to targeting a private person about purely private matters. The Supreme Court in Snyder versus Phelps made clear, right, in dicta, that we've long had intentional infliction of emotional distress claims. That's the sort of category of speech that we don't explicitly call out every time the court does. But nonetheless, we've upheld claims when it's about purely private matters and they get less rigorous protection, right? So we can square a legal agenda with the First Amendment, right? And I think we can square it with First Amendment values, right? So when we think about why, you know, free speech matters. We, you know, and a crucial account is that it's so crucial for self-governance, right? We make choices about the society in which we live or want to live in by what we see and hear and what we speak, right? But when someone's under assault, they can't speak, right? And if you think about it, rape threats and nude photos posted without consent and defamation contribute so little to the set of like ideas, whether cultural, social, political, or otherwise, to make choices about the kind of government we want to live under or the kind of society we want to live under. But what it does is silence victim self-expression. So as a victim, Zoe Yang said to me, I feel like I can't be a digital citizen. Like I am clearly, every time I write in my blog, I'm targeted and I just have to quit it because there's retribution every time I even try to engage, right? And it's true that, you know, if we regulate the harasser's speech, we are impeding their autonomy. But I think we should give left certainly less deference to speech whose whole purpose is to silence other people. And, you know, if you think about the truth-seeking theory of the First Amendment, I mean, where is the truth to debate in a rape threat? Don't rape me? In defamation and in a nude photo of someone, of their intimate images posted without consent, there's really no conversation about truths that we're having here. So I think both doctrine and First Amendment values support regulating this speech. And so much of it, though, like we know law moves very slowly, so regulators and law enforcement, it's going to take a while once we start educating them. And I know AG Harris is working hard to think of ways to get resources to better train law enforcement and peace officers in California. I wish my state of Maryland will do the same and other states. But that's just going to move slowly, right? So that's where companies in Silicon Valley can play a huge role in really teaching us and teaching users about ways in which we treat each other with respect and don't try to ruin people's economic and professional lives and their social lives. As victims tell me, I can't get a job and I can't get a date, right? And it's estimated that the kind of the class of people who are really going to experience this the most are people in their 20s. So young women in their 20s, it's estimated that over, at least by the most recent Pew report, that women in their 20s are 20%, like 20% of them will face online abuse at some point in their 20s. And that's just far too much, right? So I hope that answered, Joan, your question. Louis, oh, yeah. Oh, we have a microphone.
Danielle, okay. Thank you so much for this and for all of your work. I'm Chris Wolf. This really follows naturally from the last question. A number of state attorneys general have taken the problem you've identified and used it as a call to amend Section 230.
Right.
To put a legal obligation on the platform providers and make them susceptible to suit or right. regulation for the appearance of this kind of content. What's your view on that?
Right, and I remember, so Chris, when they had the National Attorney General's conference, right? They rolled that out, and thankfully they had you there as a speaker with Joel Reidenberg, right? It was far too broad, right? So the proposal that, my understanding of the proposal, is that the carve-out for Section 230 would no longer be as to state criminal law. And that's far too capacious, right? Because you can imagine every kind of criminal law, right? I mean, there's just it's not just revenge porn human trafficking. I think largely what drove the AG proposal to amend and change Section 230 was the concern about sort of child trafficking on websites like Backpage. But I think we need to be as targeted in our response to Section 230 because it offers a lot of benefits, right? So it's true that, you know, Section 230 does immunize the revenge porn site operator who isn't engaging in a scheme of extortion, at least arguably, right? I kind of am totally with the FTC on inducing a breach of confidence is for what they do and say, and they are responsible for that, right? But certainly revenge porn operators are shameless in saying, or they used to be until about a month ago, right, in saying we're totally immune from liability, right? If user shames people, it's on them, it's not on us, right? Like we're not responsible for user-generated content. So in my book, I propose a very narrow carve-out for Section 230. That I realize, you know, Congress can't pass a budget. I doubt they'll pass a consumer privacy bill, and I hope certainly not the one that was proposed the other day. But, you know, what does the carve-out look like? It would only apply to site operators that encourage the posting of cyberstalking defined in the way that it does in the federal cyberstalking statute, 2261, and refuse to take it down, or sites that principally host non-consensual pornography. But again, I doubt that will ever be passed, but I offer it if it ever should come to be that they become interested. Chris.
Just broadening the discussion a little bit, it seems to me that the next step in a cyber civil rights agenda might deal with mugshots. Now, the rationale being that so much of law enforcement is focused on low SES populations and minority populations, we already have EEOC decisions about arrest records and arrest records use and employment. And then we have these sites that collect mugshots and offer people $400 remove them, and they are search engine optimized so that if you Google so-and-so, their mugshot shows up. It's pretty clear that it's kind of a similar thing. But then you're dealing with a public record. Yeah. But nonetheless, it has a disproportionate impact on certain people in society, and it probably has a very profound economic effect on them. You can't change your job, can't get a job.
That's right.
Are you working on this problem?
Okay, so what's really interesting about the mugshot extortion sites, essentially what they are, is that's my understanding. So, Will, I promise I'm not calling you out about Google, but it's my understanding that Google demotes the prominence of those sites because they're so detrimental. I mean, I know generally that Google and search engines don't, right, sort of alter search results. At least that's their position. But I guess I would say that akin to mugshot, that I think it is quite true that they are no longer prominent in searches of people's names. I think we should do the same for sites that primarily host revenge porn and campus gossip or collegiate ACB that are basically cyber cesspools. But your question was, so I brought it back to what I do, but now I should answer your question, right? So am I worried about those types of sites that, of course, have different sort of a First Amendment valence, right, because it's a public record? But I think that, you know, ways in which, the sort of interest in obscurity that the European decision, the right to be forgotten or in obscurity, is how I think Julie Brill says she thinks about it. I think she's right. For certain, I think, targeted content that's really sensitive, like the nude photo or the mugshot, right, that's old, like in the way that FCRA recognizes that after 7 years, right, there are certain things that shouldn't be in your credit reports, like bankruptcies, right? I'm like talking to the FCRA expert, but yeah, so that we do recognize in law sometimes obscurity, and maybe the way to think about old mugshots, and I realize this, is to have a targeted sort of right to obscurity as to very sensitive things rather than more broad sweeping in ways that wouldn't run into the First Amendment, or even just as a policy matter for platforms or for search engines who frankly could compete on being ethical in search, just throwing it out there. It's probably not a popular thing to say, but so often victims tell me their biggest problem are their search results, right? It's true that strangers are on these sites, and for any given nude image, there are thousands of hits. So victims will say, I know that like 7,000 people looked at my picture yesterday, right? And it's devastating. But when you try to get a job and you can't because a Google search of your name, what predominates is this abuse, right? That's what's so, and I wish that search engines would take that into consideration, but I know it's hard to scale.
Is there a technical solution that might be available using the domain name system to create a do not list registry where victims or people who have mugshots or revenge porn or bankruptcy information can simply go to the domain name system and use code to regulate the use or the abuse of information that came up on the web due to an abuse of trust.
Right. So one thing that we've been talking about, so I'm working with A.G. Harris and her task force on cyber exploitation, and one thing that's come up is much in the way that the National Center for Missing Children has images that Microsoft sort of spearheaded photo DNA and hashes of images that then could be identified and taken down like child pornography right away. We could think about creating hashes of images that have been reported to providers, like whether it's Reddit or Twitter and other sort of participating providers, hash those images that have been sort of earmarked as non-consensual pornography, and then it makes it so much easier to take them down. So that's the one way in which we've been thinking about using technology to help combat the problem. I think it's very hard when it comes to defamation. We can't automate that. As you know, I feel like in talking to content policy folks, I absolutely agree, right? There are, you know, so much abuses of made up of stuff that like automation is just an ill fit. But for these photos, it seems to be that there might be a technical way to go about addressing it. So I guess thank you. No? Is that... Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Danielle. And as I said, this is a critical issue, this sort of design question, which is a major theme running throughout our conference today. Danielle has put us back on schedule, so we can take a break now for just 15 minutes, get some dessert, something else to drink, some coffee or whatever, and then resume here, as the schedule says, at quarter to the hour with the next panel. Thank you. Just 15 minutes.